Welcome to Youth Speaks Out, a show by, for, and about young people. It airs on the first Sunday of each month from 3 to 4 p.m. and is hosted by young people in Mendocino County. We want to create a place where young people can talk truthfully about important issues in our lives and have a dialogue with the community of listeners. Today's hosts are me, Jordan from Laytonville High School.
And myself, Jesse from Laytonville High School.
Our topics for today are mock trial and scapegoating the youth. We are members of the Laytonville High School mock trial team. Yesterday, we competed in Ukiah at the county courthouse, along with teams from Charter Academy of the Redwoods, Developing Virtue Girls School, Fort Bragg High, Mendocino High, and Ukiah High. Each team is linked with an attorney coach who helps the student attorneys and witnesses prepare a defense pretrial motion argument, opening and closing statements, witness questioning and response, and general courtroom etiquette. We are grateful to our teacher, Mr. Potter, along with our legal advisors, Elena Agnoli and Beth Norman. Members from all aspects of the local legal community, including judges, district attorneys, public defenders, alternate defenders, county counsel, and private practice attorneys, volunteer their time to coach teams or score and officiate during the competitions. The county mock trial program is sponsored and coordinated by the Mendocino County Office of Education.
The purpose of county mock trial competition is to give high school students the opportunity to experience the American judicial system firsthand. Student teams argue both sides of a fictitious case developed by the Constitutional Rights Foundation, the statewide coordinators of the event. This year, student team members portrayed all key roles in the case People vs. Shim, the trial of Evan Shim, who is studying for a Master's of Fine Arts degree at Hamiltonia University. Shim faces one felony count, theft by grand larceny, for the theft of treason, a painting by Fletcher Yazoo. The pretrial issue in People vs. Shim centers on the Fourth Amendment protection against unlawful search and seizure. The last time Youth Speaks Out had a mock trial as a topic, a listener called in and asked the hosts about the Innocence Project. The Innocence Project was founded in 1992 by Barry Sheck and Peter Newfield. It is a nonprofit legal organization that is committed into exonerating wrongfully convicted people through the use of DNA testing and to reforming the criminal justice system to prevent future injustice. To date, the work of the Innocence Project has led to freeing 325 wrongfully convicted people, including 20 who served time on death row. The wrongful convictions which the Innocence Project helped to overturn were not rare or isolated events. The leading cause of wrongful convictions were eyewitnesses' misidentification, unvalidated or improper forensic sciences, false confessions and incriminating statements, and unreliable informant testimony. In homicide cases that were overturned, 62% have been coerced into giving false confessions so they could plead into a lesser charge.
The other topic we want to discuss today is scapegoating the youth. In 1999, Mike Mayles wrote a book, Framing Youth, 10 Myths About the Next Generation. He pointed out that the percentage of teens committing serious crimes has actually dropped over the past 20 years. Today's teens are far less likely to use drugs or to die of drug-related causes than are people 30 years and older, and less likely to have kids out of wedlock. But they are far more likely to be associated with, and often blamed for, these social problems in newspapers, magazines, and the evening news. School massacres, which get huge media coverage but are quite rare, give the impression that schools are a dangerous place. Statistically, schools are far safer than homes, where every year 2,000 youth are murdered by parents in domestic violence. The author Mayles states that youth have been made into symbols for larger social problems, like poverty, substance abuse, and violence, and that adults have a duty to take responsibility for adult misbehaviors and quit blaming them on young people. In 2006, psychologist Robert Epstein wrote a book, The Case Against Adolescence. In it, he argues that teenagers are far more competent than we assume, and that most of their problems stem from the restrictions placed upon them. Epstein points out that our culture artificially extends childhood, primarily through our education system and restrictions on labor. The age at which Americans reach adulthood is increasing. 30 is the new 20, and most Americans now believe a person isn't an adult until age 26. He argues that we completely isolate young people from adults and create a peer culture, keeping them from working in a meaningful way. In most non-industrialized societies, young people are integrated into adult society as soon as they are capable, and there is no sign of teen turmoil. Many cultures do not even have a term for adolescence. He provides statistic that teens are subjected to 10 times as many restrictions as mainstream adults, and twice as many as incarcerated felons. He advocates that teens be allowed to work, start businesses, marry, live on their own, and make their own decisions about healthcare. He says that teenagers are far more competent than we allow them to be, because of our institutionalized extended childhood.
We hope that you will consider these controversial notions about the youth, and will be willing to discuss them with us in about 30 minutes when we open the phone lines at 707-456-9991. So, we're going to start the show by talking about our experiences with mock trial. So, Jordan, what roles did you play in yesterday's competition at the county courthouse in Ukiah?
Well, during the competition yesterday, I did my, I have two roles, as a matter of fact. I'm the pretrial attorney for our prosecution team and a defense attorney for our defense team.
How do you like pretrial?
I'm not sure how I can say I like it. I'm going to say how I like it now. I like it
better. Okay, then describe it first and then say what you think about it.
Okay, right, that works. Pretrial is really technical, and you have to have a lot of lateral thinking. You have to think around issues and find ways to make your argument support those issues instead of just being presented with something having to act it out. You have to think much more. It's much more technical, and I actually like that a lot more than the regular trial.
Really?
Yeah.
I would not want to do pretrial just because it looks so incredibly hard, since you have to know like every single case, like People versus Illinois and all that.
It is so hard. You have to, we're given a list of, what is it? It's around 20 or 25 cases that we have to.
I don't know. I've never done pretrial.
Well, I have. we're given a list of between 20 and 25 cases, and those are the only ones we can use. We can't use any outside of it. And we pretty much have to have a perfect knowledge of the cases. We have to memorize them and pretty not use note cards during the thing and know exactly what the judge is talking about when they question us on the cases. And then we also have to memorize our four-minute statement and be able to think laterally in case we get some kind of an interruption.
Which you will.
Oh, yeah, every time. I had, yesterday I had five or six? Yeah, the judge will ask you questions and you'll get thrown off, so you can't just go along something that's memorized. You have to remember what the last thing you said was and then think around it and come up with a whole new argument on the fly.
Yeah, I would not want to do that. I'm so thankful.
I like it better because it's not just reading off a list. You have to, I don't know.
Yeah, but arguing with the other team is so much more fun.
I get to argue with the judge.
Okay, so the charges and evidence against Evan Shem. Well, the charge for Evan Shem is theft by grand larceny, and there's three elements to this crime, which is first that the property taken was worth more than $950, second that the property was taken from the owner without consent, and finally that the property was taken long enough to cause distress or was intended to be kept permanently. And I'm on the prosecution side, so I'm making Shim guilty.
He didn't do it.
He did. But we have our expert testify, and as well as the defense's our expert. We each have an art expert on our side, so they kind of cancel out. But they both testify that the painting is worth $100,000 due to the recent death of the artist. And the owner testifies that it's not his painting because the brushstrokes seem more controlled. And because this trial, first, it's that there's this big rich guy and he has a gallery. And in this gallery, his favorite painting that he's seen since 1978 that he's grown up with, is painting Treason. It's obscure painting. It's just kind of like scribbles on a paper, you know?
Don't knock it. I love that painting.
I don't. But he has a 4th of July party, and he invites 200 people, and he has the defendant, Evan Shem, be a docent for the evening, which meant that he had to escort guests in and out of the gallery and describe the paintings to them and everything, and then later lock up at 9 p.m. And so Evan Shem, at 9 p.m., on our side, it's she exits the gallery, and she forgets to lock the door. Then, like, 15 minutes later, she runs back to the gallery with her backpack that she claims has art supplies in.
Oh, it had art supplies in it.
And then she locks it. Then, the next morning, the rich guy, Marty McCulloch, he walks into his gallery, and he thinks something is off with Treason, but he shrugs it off, you know, and later he receives a phone call from Bernie Worcester, the prosecution's expert, art expert, and she says she was asking about Treason, if it was for sale, because I guess someone had previously called saying that the painting was for sale and asking how much it would be worth. And he was like, no, I would never sell my painting. So he walks into his gallery, and then he looks at the brush strokes, and he testifies that they seem more controlled. And that's how it all began.
That might sound really confusing, but it's really hard to explain. Any of you listeners, this might sound really basic. You would think that the evidence we have would be fingerprints and DNA evidence.
No fingerprints,
no DNA evidence. It's all...
It's a pain for prosecution.
It's all circumstantial because we have the testimony... I don't have the testimony. You have the testimony of the owner of the painting who claims that something is wrong with it, and the two art experts who completely disagree with each other.
Yeah.
And so those kind of are negated, and the owner of the painting, of course, is going to have a bias. But the only other details we have are that the defendant wore a backpack to the party, and the other alternate suspect, his friend Charlie Gibbons, who had a history of stealing, wore a large tan trench coat to a warm evening in the middle of summer to a formal party. Those are pretty
and
much...
And insisted on going with Evan
And Chim. Insisted on going. We have to make a case out of those details.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Well, there is one thing. One of the defense's witnesses, T.M. Little, he's another rich guy, you know, he's an art seller.
Oh, yeah.
And he asks Evan Chim because the reason why Evan Chim had a backpack full of, quote-unquote, art supplies.
No, there's no quote. They were art supplies.
Yeah,
no,
art supplies.
Quit knocking my witness.
But Tian Little asks Evan Chim how the painting's going of the fireworks show and all the people, all the guests. And Evan Chim says it's going great. And then later, Evan Chim's witness statement says that she never actually started the sketch. She just told Tian Little that it was going good. So that's a little suspicious.
Just being polite.
All
right, so do you want to elaborate more on what you did since I kind of talked about pretrial?
Okay, well, yesterday I was prosecuting attorney. I do one cross-examination, and I do two direct examinations of our witnesses. And then I also give the closing argument. And I also got to, for the first time yesterday, be bailiff for the defense team. And that was pretty fun, since I wasn't completely sure what I should do when. But yeah, are you enjoying your first year mock trial with all this work?
Oh, well, I'm enjoying it, definitely. I really wish that my first year I could have been a witness so I would actually understand what's going on before the first competition. Usually the first year members are just a witness, and they just have to know what they said in their witness statement and respond to the question the attorneys ask. However, I was made, I was
me and Mr. Potter.
Yeah,
we pretty much made him
you
be
guys
an attorney.
Are great, yeah.
We
not
had
only
plan.
A pretrial attorney, which arguably, like you said, is one of the hardest things in mock trial, but also a defense attorney. So, and we have a prosecution trial in the morning and a defense trial in the afternoon. So I am always doing something.
Well, I was yesterday. I was bailiff.
You were bailiffing. You sat there and said, like, things.
I had to swear eight witnesses in and address the court. Yeah. Yeah, I remember we went recently to Middleton.
Middletown?
Whatever. I say Middleton. But we went there for a scrimmage, like a last-minute scrimmage, a week before the county competition. And one of the girls there, I think it was their teacher coach, she remembered me from my first year of mock trial. She's like, oh yeah, I remember you. You were the girl with pink hair. You're Dallas DeCamp, right? And like I don't remember what my witness name was. So like I'm sitting here and I was like the whole ride back, I was trying to remember the name of who I was my first year. It was great. That makes me really happy. I got a medal that year for outstanding defense witness. Thank you.
Why don't you start bragging a little bit? That'd be nice.
So what did you think about the teams yesterday?
I think we all did pretty well. I mean, I don't know. I don't really have a lot to compare it to. You have a lot more experience than me.
Well, I've seen yesterday, who'd we go against in the morning? Charter Academy, right?
Yeah, Charter Academy.
Julian on their side, I think he is like the best. He's on the defense team, and I think he's on the prosecution as well. He is such, like, they just had two people quit their team recently these past 2 weeks, and he was definitely good considering they just had someone quit, and he was sitting there like making questions off of the like witness statement instead of having like already like questions pre-planned, and he's light on his feet. He's good. And I forget his name, but I call him Big Red. Jordan on their side, from Charter Academy, the guy with red hair. He's really good too.
I have no idea who you're talking about.
He used to work at the movie theater. He's awesome.
Okay, so more about the actual competition. We address the judge, but the funny thing about mock trial is it's not based on who actually wins the trial. We're scored on by three judges, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Three different judges, and whoever has the highest score wins.
Well, they're actually attorneys. They're not judges.
Attorney.
They're actual attorneys that are sitting in there judging us. How well we.
They're judging.
Yeah. They're judging.
They're
judging attorneys.
Yeah, they're a group of three attorneys who sit in the jury box and just score everything we do. So scorers is more accurate. Not judges, because we have the one judge who's a judge.
But they give us a score 1 through 5 of how well they think that we personally did in the trial. So every single person gets a number for how well they did, and it's so terrifying because you want to get a 5, but a lot of the scorers either give like they're more of 3s or 4s, or a lot of them are 4s or 5s, and it's like completely random, and
I think I got some solid 2s in there.
It's a lot of nerves. Gosh. they, at the end of the trial, they sit there and they provide us with feedback, which is really helpful so we can be prepared for the next trial. And
now, these two questions are kind of, they're related to mock trial, and they're also about our actual judicial system, excuse me. The first one I'm going to ask is, did you feel like justice was done and is done in our legal system? First, do you feel like justice was done in mock trial? I know you're going to say, because you're prosecution, I know your answer.
No, I really don't know if Evan Shem did it or not, because, I mean, there's so, like...
There's no evidence.
for me, it's either Evan Shem did this or he didn't. There's absolutely no other way someone else could have pulled off this crime. Yeah. Either, like, she did or she didn't. But I have no idea if she did it or not.
Yeah, one of the other pieces of evidence in there is it's testified by the detective that investigated Evan Shem, the defendant, that usually art crimes just involve the painting being missing after it's stolen. But in this case, there was a replica put there, and there are no known photographs of this painting, and it wasn't available for public viewing. So there's pretty much only two people that really could have done it, and that would be the owner and the defendant who could have made that replica. But
and then one of their defense's alternate suspects is Charlie Gibbons, who was briefly Evan Shem's roommate for a few months.
Briefly for a few months.
Yeah, briefly for a few months. But part of the defense's argument is that Charlie Gibbons could have replaced it, although she had never seen treason before.
Could have done it. She could have saw the replica.
Okay.
Could have happened.
Okay. But
it did happen.
That, like, that's why I think it's either it was Evan Shim or it wasn't. But I think a lot of times in our judicial system, justice isn't served just because of the lack of evidence or evidence pointing to one person who is actually innocent.
Yeah. Next question. Do you feel like the case depended more on the skill of the lawyers or on the truth? Well, in this, the case is balanced perfectly so that neither sides have an advantage.
No, defense definitely has an advantage.
Well, of course the defense has an advantage because the prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. But, yeah. Prosecution has the advantage of there only being one person that could have committed this crime.
Well, it's true.
I just admitted that in one defense.
And but the defense is, did this crime even, like, actually happen? Because it was in a gallery, a locked gallery.
There's the defense's contention that there are... that if a crime did take place, which the defense is not conceding, that there are at least 200 other possible suspects.
No.
Yeah.
No.
There are.
What was your question?
Okay, so it would be, in our judicial system, do you think the outcome of the case depends more on the skill of the lawyers or the truth?
Well, there's not really a lot of truth in this trial, considering that one of, like, Charlie Gibbons testifies to his never entering the rich guy's house during a firework display, and there's a witness that claims that she saw Charlie Gibbons in the house.
Someone's lying.
Well, in here, wait, let me find this. I don't know where it is. But, like, it could have been simply just, like, she saw the wrong person, because, I don't know, it could have been. You never know.
I know.
Really?
Yeah.
Somewhere in here, I don't know where it is. But, you never know, it could have just been a mistaken identity.
Yeah. Now, how about lawyer skills versus the truth in real trials that actually determine if a person is guilty or innocent?
I think definitely if your lawyer has some serious skills, then if you're, like, on defense, well, no matter what, like, I think your lawyer skills are definitely very important, but the truth kind of, I mean, it can help you, but it could also not help you because someone could be telling their truth, what they think is the truth, but it isn't the same. It's, like, completely different what actually happened.
Yeah.
So, I think the lawyer skills kind of do help you more in real trial because you never know if people are right about what they thought or not, you know?
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. Describe a few things that you have learned in mock trial. You've been in it a lot longer than I have, so.
3 years now.
Someone's cool.
Well, I learned a lot about being in court and stuff. I don't know. I really like it. I really like mock trial. I don't think I would do it in college or anything, but I really like mock trial. It taught me important speaking skills, and if I ever need to be in court, what to do. What has it taught you this year, your first and last year?
Hey.
Senior.
I'm going to get held back. That is what Miss Potter, our school superintendent, told me as a joke. She goes, "Oh, we're just going to hold you back so we can get you on the mock trial team next year."
They're not going to accept your English transcript from Indo.
Crap. Okay, so did you ask a few things that I've learned?
Yeah.
I've learned that... I don't know. I'm not sure if I've learned new things, but I've helped build on the things that I already have a lot.
You're not, like, as awkward speaking.
Yeah, that is true.
And I really like...
Okay, hold on. Let me interrupt you real quick. I'm like, yeah. Anyway, last year, I could not have done much.
Oh, my God. Last year was stupid. Oh, my God. I was about to be the defendant, and I was on the defense team. I was about to become a defendant in a different case. Ugh, I don't even want to go into that. It's just going to make me, like, go off for 20 minutes.
I just got what you said. Oh, that's funny. Anyway, what were you saying before I interrupted you? Sorry about that.
I can't. I'll go off for 20 minutes because that just made me mad.
Can't even. No. Well, before I interrupted you, you were going to ask me something.
I don't remember.
Oh, wonderful.
It's your fault.
I know.
So, what do you think about scapegoating the youth?
Are we moving on to that yet?
I am.
You're moving on to it?
Or the Innocence Project?
Yeah, let's move. Yeah, the Innocence Project.
Oh, this is a good point with the this trial, too. The fingerprints and DNA evidence. Because on the painting found at Marty McCloak's mansion, there's smudged fingerprints on the painting, so the forensic can't be used.
It's clearly stated in the stipulations you can't question the availability of that evidence. Now you're questioning it.
No, I'm not. I'm simply stating that it's not available. It's an out-of-court
statement. It's hearsay.
No.
Okay, anyway, the Innocence Project. The Innocence Project is a project that was started by who, Jesse?
I don't remember.
Okay. It was started by...
Look. Keep going.
Okay, it was started by two guys to help overturn the decisions of a...
Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld.
Neufeld. It's an organization that helps overturn the charges brought against people that are innocent, hence Innocence Project. And it has helped... it has exonerated 325 convicted people convicted of crimes... by using DNA evidence and things like that.
And what I was talking about for someone testifying to seeing Charlie Gibbons inside the house. In the Innocence Project, leading causes of wrongful convictions include eyewitness misidentification, unvalidated or improper forensic sciences, false confessions and incriminating statements, or unreliable informant testimonies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't agree. Just can't do it. Yeah, and this is a funny little statistic here. 20 out of the 325 people exonerated through DNA evidence serve time on death row.
Can you imagine, like, having that happen to you?
Yeah, and we were talking about this before the show. The reason why that happens is they're given the option if they... plead guilty to the crime, they get a lesser sentence than if it was drug out through a trial. So people are pleading guilty to crimes they didn't do just because they know that if they do go to trial, they might lose and get life in prison instead
like
of 20 years.
Yeah, four times the conviction.
Yeah. It's... Yeah.
Honestly, if I was in that situation, I probably would do the same. Just if I, like, if all the evidence pointed at me, and even though I didn't do it, and, like... If, like, say, a lot of times one of the problems is you don't have an alibi, like, you know, saying that you were here at this specific place at this specific time, and a lot of times, like, people are just like, oh, I was at home with this person, you know, but they're, like, one of the suspects, too, and you're just, it just looks awful.
Yeah. And here's another one in the Innocence Project work. Oh, excuse me. Out of the 325 exonerations... the true suspects and perpetrators have been identified in 160 of the DNA exonerated cases.
Well,
I don't even know how to justify that. Maybe some of those were before DNA evidence was reliable. We didn't have, weren't able to use it, but that's insane. Wow.
Yeah, I know how that helped when DNA started coming out, you know, and they were able to test it. A lot of the evidence, like, they would save, like, you know, in lockers and storage bins and stuff. And they're like, oh, we have DNA now, so now we can go. Oh, that we convicted the wrong person. I guess you're free to go. So, do you think that media overplays the youth violence in media and everything?
That media overplays the effect youth have on violence and the violence towards and from youth?
Yeah.
Yes.
Why?
I don't know. It's things like the school shootings that the school massacres, quoting that from the media, that are brought up so many times. I still hear things about that on the media.
Yeah.
When, again, we were talking about this before the show, but I believe it's 30 students are killed per year in school shootings. But, you know, that's a lot, but again, the statistic we read, 2,000 students are murdered at home in domestic violence situations. 2,000 children. It's much more dangerous to be at home than it is at school, statistically. And now, I'm not saying that because I'm not trying to point out that all parents are bad. That's not my intention here. But it's just these school shootings are just blown so far out of proportion. It's crazy.
Well, yeah, the media only, like, decides to report on things like that just to scare you, because then they'll get all the views that they want, you know? And that's the only stories they really
report. Oh, geez. I saw something like that the other day. Okay, this is a good example of that. It was Nancy Grace, and it was on Twitter. She posted something, and the hashtag said, "dead baby in a trunk."
What?
Why? What?
That's terrifying.
Just to get... Why post something like that on social media just to get views and... It's ridiculous.
Okay.
I mean, absolutely everything is done for ratings.
Well, yeah. Why do you think they still have their show?
Why do you think they make money?
Mm-hmm. So, what do you think about the media's portrayal of youth led to overreaction by the police? Oh, good case. There's many good cases of this.
I'm confused.
What do you think about the media portrayal of youth that leads to the overreaction by police?
Okay, I see. The media portrayal of youth is that all youth are dangerous and irrational and things like that. Well.
Well, irrational, yes.
Irrational, yes. That one. That's not portrayed by the media. But the dangerous part of it is... Well, let's just focus on one thing here right now. Drugs and serious crimes like that, I believe they're down a significant percentage from even a few decades ago, or even 30-year-olds now.
For drug-related deaths.
For drug-related deaths and, violent crimes and things like that. The percentages are way lower, but for some reason, I don't know, what the reason is. That's why I say for some reason. There's a reason behind it. Ratings. The media loves to point out those exact same things. Even though statistics say that it's the exact opposite.
Well, like I said, the media likes reporting things that don't happen every day, but, like, blow it up out of proportions.
Yeah. And the other thing I read, I'm not sure where I read this recently, but there was all that talk after the school shootings that... violent video games lead violence like that. When just about every single study ever done, and you guys could look this up if you wanted, violent video games provide a way for students to actually, or for children and youth to vent their anger, and it actually, in children that play video games like that, violent video games, the rate of serious crimes is actually down a lot. That I think that's pretty interesting.
I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah.
But I assumed so.
I just assumed. That's what the media was doing.
I know, to get my frustration out, I like playing basketball. Because girls' basketball, that is the most violent sport. I'm so serious. Like, there's one girl on her team, if there's like a jump ball that's like on the ground and everything, she'll come out of nowhere and just like hop on the ground and grab that ball. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Saw that a few times in the game the other day.
But I think just people that don't have a way already to relieve their stress just end up like going mad and popping.
Yeah. There was the that other statistic. It was youth are faced with 10 times as many restrictions as modern-day adults.
Oh, yeah.
And twice as many restrictions as incarcerated felons.
And Marines.
Yeah, no, I think active it was like Marines. 6 times as many restrictions as active duty armed service members. What do you think about that?
I think that's ridiculous. I mean, I mean, I don't really feel that restricted, but I do feel restricted, but I mean, not to that extent. Maybe it's just because of where we live, but I can definitely see, like, you can't be driving out past 10 o'clock. You can't be driving before, like, 6 a.m. in the morning or something like that.
Yeah.
With your provisional license. You have to go to school, and you have to go to school every single day, and if you miss a certain number of days in a semester or in a quarter, then you get a singe notice, right? Or whatever it's called.
Yeah, you get a truancy letter.
Yeah.
And your parents can be arrested.
Yeah.
What am I trying to say? I don't know why I said whoa three times, but I did. So, here we go. We're talking about school and restrictions like that. This doesn't really have to do with restrictions, but this is kind of an interesting point. Again, it's about studies against popular belief. What time does school start? 8:10?
Yep.
Jeez, I don't even know. That's okay. The senior coming out in me. School starts at 8:10 when just about every single scientific study done shows that adolescent brains aren't fully active until about 10:30.
Yeah, and guess when
you have trigonometry in the morning.
Guess when trigonometry ends? It starts at 8:10 and it ends at 10:57 or 47.
10:40. Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah.
And then I have calculus right after that.
Yeah.
Know, right before lunch. Do you know how tiring that is? I'm so close to falling asleep in that class every single day.
Yeah, well, I just woke up when I go to trig.
Yeah. You did just drive.
So?
It kind of wakes you up a little bit.
No.
It's better than being in a wood shop where you just, like, sometimes, yeah, okay. Anyway, let's continue.
But there's many restrictions in school. Like, teachers will sit there on their phones.
Oh, geez.
For, like, the whole class period, and then
Clash of Clans.
Oh my god, that's such a pain. The teachers will sit there. Well, it's more specifically one. Well, it's mostly one that will sit there during class and do it.
During class, yes.
Yeah, but like the teacher will make the whole class wait and like not let them do anything. Just make the class wait for them to finish Clash of Clans, their little battle going on, before they will start the class. And then if you pull out your phone, you're in trouble.
Don't get me wrong. Great teacher, but ridiculous.
Yeah. Obsession.
Obsession with technology.
It's not technology. It's that game.
It's just the game, yeah. Jesus.
It's not the game's fault. It's his fault.
Blame the teachers, not the games.
Okay, here's another thing about restrictions on driving. The mandatory school and job restrictions. You know, you have to get like one of those little papers from the school approving that you can work.
Okay, so it's the three questions, the driving restrictions, I forgot the second one.
The the working permit paper you have to get from the school.
Yeah, and wasn't there a third one?
Mandatory school.
Okay, all right. Okay, yeah. Okay, I say okay a lot. I do that in mock trial. I say, okay, all right. Anyway, we're talking about driving permits. That's right. I forgot again. Yeah.
Yeah,
So, what is it now? You have to have your provisional license for 6 months, and then...
No, you have your...
What?
Permit.
No, not permit for 6 months, and then you can get a provisional license.
For a year, or until you turn 18.
Yeah.
Which means that you can't drive anybody under the age of 18 in your vehicle, and you can't be out past a certain time. But in order to get your license, you have to spend like $600 in driving fees, like for driving lessons.
Lessons, yeah.
And it is ridiculous because it's only like 3 hours each, I think.
Yeah, you have to have 6 hours total. No, yeah, they're 2 hours each. Three sessions.
So
yeah.
Like $600.
It's outrageous.
But yeah, you have to have three sessions in order to be able to get your
Your permit. Yeah, not even
no,
your
not
license.
Your permit.
Yeah.
No.
Oh no, you have to take one. Excuse me. You have to take one of the driving lessons to get your permit even validated.
You just have to take driver's ed.
No, you don't. Not to get it validated.
Oh, validated. Yeah.
You can take driver's ed. Go to the DMV. Take the test. Pass it perfectly. But your permit is not valid until you take your first driving lesson, which is over $200?
Yeah.
Or
no, I think it's like 200.
High hundreds, something? I don't know. It's crazy.
And then you have to get two more of that, And then I didn't find out until a few months ago, and I've had my license for about a year now, just over. And I found out a couple months ago from one of my friends that apparently you can go to the Ukiah Speedway, spend about $100, and it will count as all three of your driving lessons.
I still don't understand that, but
I don't either. And I'm so upset I didn't know that, because it's so much cheaper. And it's like, the driving lessons are ridiculously expensive. And then after you do those lessons, then you have to go to the DMV, and you have to spend, I forget how much money, like $25 or something.
It's $30 for the
your driving test.
Oh, I have no idea for the test.
I think it's about the same. But yeah, is it? Do you have to spend $30 on your permit test?
I think it was $24 for the permit test.
Probably.
And the permit, yeah. Anyway, let's get off of restrictions. Let's talk about this. I've noticed this a lot. I'm not sure if you... I know you've noticed this. It seems like, you know, we would look at pictures of our parents when they were our age, and we would think, geez, they look so much older than us. And, you know, I'm sure everybody was like that, and there was the gap. You could tell that, you know, people were looking younger and acting younger. But now it's like we're seniors, we can look down at freshmen and think how young they look and act. It's like it's increasing exponentially.
It's a logarithmic
function. You're in trouble.
I saw one of my friend's little brothers, and he was at the high school, and he was waiting for the bus and stuff. I was messing around with him. I was like, "Oh, are you in high school now?" He's like, "No, I got two more years." And I look at him, and he's like this 4-foot kid, and I my mind is completely blown.
I love how he says that like it's a prison sentence. How much he has left? I got two more years left until I'm out of here.
He said, "I wish I have two more years."
Well, yeah, a prisoner would say that too.
Oh gosh, that's true. Well, we are kept in a room full of teenagers all day, every day.
And the food we're served.
Oh God, what food? Actually, yeah, what food? Well, it's better.
It's been getting better recently.
It's better than many schools. Like if you go down to the city,
I saw a picture. I don't remember where it was. But it was passed off for macaroni and cheese. They were just cooked shells, the little macaroni shells, thrown in a pan with those little Kraft single slices thrown on top of them. Ugh. They weren't even melted into it. That was what passed as macaroni and cheese.
That's disgusting. That lasagna I had was pretty good the other day.
I didn't have the lasagna.
I didn't for the first day, and then they had it for leftovers, and it was good. But
leftover lasagna. Yep. All right.
But yeah, like I said, this school food is definitely better than a lot.
Yeah. We're going to open the phone lines now. The phone number is 707-456-9991. Everyone is welcome to call, and we'd especially like to encourage the youth, their parents, teachers, and concerned friends in the listening audience. Please call in if you have questions or insights on mock trial and framing the youth. What do you think of the mock trial program? Have you ever been involved in them?
Do you think our judicial system is fair? Are there parts of our system that you would change? Do you know anything about the Innocence Project?
How have you learned about the way the courts work? Could you describe your experience as being on a jury?
Are youth unfairly blamed for societal problems? Are you nervous when you pass a group of young people on the street?
Would more punishment make the teenagers better citizens? Should youth ever be tried in courts as adults?
What do you think of the idea that we are overextending childhood with mandatory school and labor restrictions on youth?
Would some youth be better off dropping out of school and developing skills in the workforce? At what age do you accept youth as being truly adult?
Please call in and be a part of this conversation. The phone number is 707-456-9991. When you call, please be ready to turn down your radio, or we will get a very confusing echo. The number is 456-9991. Please call in and be a part of this discussion. We'd really like to hear from you. Caller, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Hey, you all have got to be the bravest radio hosts in the world, going from a small nonprofit like KZYX up against the biggest nonprofit in the world, the NFL. But so be it. I'm listening. I'd rather hear your driving experience than the drive on the field there. A couple of things. I'm curious on your mock trial. With the lack of fingerprint evidence, was there any video involved as far as within the house?
No, not at all.
Yeah. No, there was no forensic or physical evidence, and we are one of the stipulations in the case is we can't question the availability of that evidence.
Huh. That's interesting, because that comes up quite often in cases here in Mendocino as to why the officers, whether it's Ukiah PD or the sheriffs, don't have their cameras on, and it seems to be a little arbitrary as to whether they decide not to or to turn them on. But I'm going to suggest that maybe it was the owner, because he had the most to profit from it. If he switches a fake for a real, and he had the real to have anybody who faked the painting have the real painting to look right at.
Well, actually, in his gallery, he has paintings that are worth like millions of dollars, multi-million dollar paintings, actually. And this was actually one of his lesser value paintings.
Which makes it easier to get away with. It might be just enough to pay off his debt. So I don't necessarily think that that should be used to exclude the possibility. And then you get into the youth being scapegoated. People with backpacks, oh, they probably did it. And the person that looked like the guy, I forget his name now, Gibbons?
Yeah.
Maybe it was the owner trying to dress like that and having a witness out there saying it. If he was, you know, these insurance things and ripoffs go on all the time. And if he had benefit of not only possibly selling a fake painting, but if it was found out getting money for a fake painting that wasn't that much being stolen, gee, it wouldn't look that obvious to the insurance company. So don't eliminate him from your possible suspect list.
I am, since I'm prosecution.
I'm defense.
The problem is you have to be open-minded. And one of the responsibilities of a prosecutor is to be ethical. And if they know something that would exonerate the suspect, even though it's not convenient for them or something that maybe society is comfortable with, they have that responsibility to divulge that exonerating evidence to the defense and to keep the ethics of the office up. And I would suggest that you recheck that, because that's a very important part of people trusting the system or not, and it goes to a lot of youth who don't have money to hire an attorney, or their parents who might get blamed for something that actually one of the siblings, a bad brother, a bad sister, it's not always the parents, or it could be their friend. And then, you know, people point fingers, and the most likely person might actually be the least likely when you follow the money.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I think it's really important to really parse it out and not just assume anything and take the most convenient, most likely, because it's not always that. And society has a tendency to vote guilty on things where they're uncomfortable with the implications of the not guilty. So somebody with a hoodie that was completely innocent, but because maybe they even had a beer, which, by the way, isn't necessarily a crime, it gets found guilty. And maybe they had drank a beer somewhere else and they were carrying a beer to another place and were less than 0.01, but had alcohol in their system, but fingered for something that they didn't do. And, you know, that just automatically makes that person more likely to be a suspect. By the way, just for purposes of full disclosure, I don't drink, but I've got a payphone, and there's a steel reserve can right in front of me. If I were to touch it and throw it away, guess what? My fingerprints are on it, even though I was throwing it away, and there's a container around it that I did pick up, and the thing is half full. So just because of proximity doesn't mean somebody's guilty. One more thing before I go, I want to suggest that you all think about this. When the choices are guilty or not guilty, it kind of predetermines that the jury is more inclined to find guilty, even if they think they don't have enough evidence to convict somebody, but they think they did it. I think that there should be a third option, and that should be beyond a reasonable doubt, that the case is not beyond a reasonable doubt, and therefore they can't conclude who's lying, who's not lying, and maybe they're all lying and they're all full of it, you know. So something to think about is a third option that should be maybe proposed on by initiative, that we have the opposition of not beyond a reasonable doubt as opposed to not guilty. That's really what not guilty does, but because it's not guilty, people are reluctant. If they think, even though the evidence doesn't prove it, that they are, they don't want to vote not guilty, but they would be if it was not beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, yeah, that's what we do in mock trial. The defense team just simply tries to point out other means, motive, and opportunity to show that there are other suspects that I could have done could have committed this crime. So if the evidence isn't beyond a reasonable doubt, then the defendant is let go and like not guilty.
However, it makes it hard for a jury to, because they only give the jury two choices. That's what I'm really pointing to there. Even though it's available, they have to vote not guilty in order to invoke beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
Maybe they think he is guilty and they don't want to do that. So it's a psychological aspect of kind of rigging the system, so to speak. By the way, who were the three attorneys that were acting as scorer judges, and who was the actual judge that was in your trial? Can you guys tell us that?
I don't remember in the morning. Do you remember who was there in the morning?
The judge?
Yeah. Was it Mormon?
Oh, no. Mormon's next weekend.
Oh, I don't remember.
Was it a woman?
Yeah, it was.
Was it Cindy Mayfield? Or?
Yeah, it was Mayfield.
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. See, I've been there. I'm speaking from experience, and unfortunately, mine wasn't a mock trial. However, I did okay representing myself, and I did it based on things that I learned when I went to school in mock trials, so... Your point about hopefully if you do go to court, you do have a much better background and you rotate the position so you know what each side is supposed to do, not supposed to do, and what they're thinking. So it does give you a heads up. But don't be afraid to go into that law library and just start digging in, because there's a lot of things you can find by just randomly opening the actual physical books as opposed to going online. That's something that I've tried to point out to people, that it's a thing that we've lost with the Internet. You can be looking for one case, and you just randomly access another case that's in the vicinity that happens to be even more on mark than the one that was suggested to you as the one that might help you defend your case. And I found it extremely valuable. So good luck to you guys in your career, and keep that Innocence Project going. It saved a lot of lives that were destined for execution. My God, what a system, huh?
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Enjoy the Super Bowl.
Go Seahawks. Just saying.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hello, I'm sorry. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Yeah, we can.
Okay. I'm sorry to change the subject, but I want to go back to a conversation you had when you first started the show, and you were talking about adolescence and how it is only something that, a term that is used in North America, in our culture, in North American culture, and is a really that such a time period. Or at least I thought that that's what you were talking about. And you know, and when should people really have the responsibility of adulthood? Well, you know, if you know anything about psychology, and you know that adolescence is really an important time, and that in many cultures where there are like a caste system, people do not have the opportunity to have an adolescence. They go right from childhood into adulthood. And during that time of adolescence, of course, it's true, it's ego development. And you know, that's what's happening. But that is really an important stage in human development. And then from there comes individuation. So it's very important, that stage of adolescence. I wanted to be sure to make that clear. You can check the work of Carl Jung if you want to on this subject. And I also wanted to say that children really want responsibility. In my experience for over 40 years teaching and running a school, it's just very much like Montessori said, children want to take responsibility, but children need to learn, and they do in a good environment, that there is a difference between responsibility and freedom and license. So that, you know, a lot of free schools, there are no limits, but that's not freedom, that's license. There is no freedom without responsibility. Thank you very much for letting me say my piece.
Mm-hmm. I have a question real quick.
Sure.
Do you think that our culture are overextending childhood?
No. I think that, you know, when you say overextending childhood, if you mean they're overprotecting, are we overprotecting? Are we not allowing our children to climb trees, to walk? you know, because we're afraid that they're going to get kidnapped, to climb trees, to have snowball fights. Are we not allowing them that responsibility, taking steps into responsibility? Yes, you know, that is happening in a lot of places in our culture where we're not allowing children to move forward. Now, I think also that a lot of children have much more responsibility, just like in these cultures, they have a responsibility for families at a way too young of an age, and so they don't get an opportunity to develop their desire, their, you know, the thing that they really excites them.
So
I hope that answers your question.
Well, do you think we're holding back on adult activities like working, since many people can't get a job until they're 16, and even then they have to get a permit approved by the school to get a job?
Well, in a good school, a child starts teaching other kids what they know. And then as move into adolescence, then that child, not only, at least in my school, not only does that child have full responsibility for a section, but they get paid at least minimum wage for doing that. I hope that answers your question. I think that, you know, I had a job that when I was 16 in high school. I know that my kids did. And I think, you know, also babysitting is a job. And, you know, I used to say, if you don't have fun, you can fire your babysitter. The babysitter is not supposed to be on the phone. They're supposed to be providing good, fun time for that child. Fun mm-hmm. is a really important part of education. If there's no pleasure, that's not real education. Because the whole term education for school comes from the Greek word leisure, which of course means pleasure. I gave you a whole bunch more now. Do you have some more questions?
I think that's all for now.
Well, thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, so the number is 456-9991. Please call in and be a part of our discussion.
What do you think about what some of the callers said?
Well, I think waiting till you're 16 kind of is a long time to be able to get a permit for a job.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's just me. Maybe it's just because I'm too lazy to get a job.
Man, I was still 16 my senior year of high school.
Yeah, like I turned 16 my sophomore year at the very end of sophomore year. And people like you are little babies.
People like me. Yeah, way to single me out on that one.
I did.
Yeah. Yeah, I turned 16 almost, or I turned 17 almost halfway through my senior year of high school.
So he'll be 17 during his first semester of college.
Yeah.
Which is kind of ridiculous, but so you'll have your provisional license until you're 18 in college. So that means that when you're in college, you can't drive anybody around that's under the age of 23, right?
Nah.
Yeah.
25, I don't know, 20-something.
23 or 25, one of those.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure. Okay, so that's all for this month's edition of Youth Speaks Out. Your hosts today have been myself, Jesse.
And me, Jordan.
Laytonville Headley Starts Coalition Drug-Free Communities Project is proud to support this month's Youth Speaks Out. Our Environmental Prevention Strategies in the Community, also known as EPIC, is a project funded by the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Through our organization and coalition, we are working towards reducing youth substance abuse through a variety of strategies in the Laytonville community. If you are interested in learning more about our efforts, please contact Laytonville Healthy Start at 707-984-8089 or email JAMA at jamashields@pacific.net. Youth Speaks Out is produced and directed by Dan Roberts, who may be reached by mail at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490, or through the website www.youthspeaksout.net. There you can find out more information about the project, get addresses for contacting us, get a copy of the show, and listen to many hours of previous programs and streaming audio. The views expressed on this program are not necess- are not necessarily those of KZYX. They are the views of those who express them. Youth Speaks Out is normally aired on the first Sunday of each month. Our next show will be in 4 weeks. That is March 1st at 3 p.m. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in March.